need some, some wealth, some comforts, and some sensual stimulations, but you can't get carried away. Those are the materialists. Anybody richer than me has got to be a materialist. But I'm all right. That's generally the attitude. Of course, how do you judge? People just say many times, well, everybody should be able to satisfy their needs. But how do we know what our needs are? In so many ways, by hearing materialistic sound vibration, we get an artificial conception of our needs. From the time you're young, you're hearing things. You need this, you need that. When you grow up, when you get older, you have to have this, you have to do that. And that hearing has an effect on the consciousness. So by the time you're 15, 16, so on, you really have some strong urges and some strong conceptions about what you need. You really have some, concrete ideas. And by the time you're 21, definitely, by that time you're ready to go for it. I know what I need. I'm going to go out and get it. And you're like that until you're 60, 65, at which time you're really exhausted and spent and withered. All this comes by hearing. And if we're constantly in touch with the wrong kind of sound, then we never really have a chance to right ourselves. So this is a very subtle art, very subtle science. How to get a grip on your life based on what you're hearing. Did you ever think of it in terms of that? Anybody here ever think that you're molded by what you hear, even against your best, what you think are your best powers of discrimination? Just like, for example, if you're around people who talk about the Algerians all the time. All those Algerians, they're really just bad people. They're really fanatical. They have no idea how to run a country. Even in spite of your best efforts to be neutral, after a while you start thinking like that. Well, every country has its particular group that's supposed to, not do things just right. Well, you know how they are. You just really can't get it together. Our country would be so much better if that group would learn how to behave properly. And so you may say, I'm not prejudiced. I'm an open-minded person. I cannot entertain such stuff. When you constantly hear like that, it just begins to build up in your consciousness. Actually, our whole conception of who we are, our whole conception of what we think, comes through the ear, based on sound vibration. For example, if you listen to popular music all the time, it's always filling you with hopes for material enjoyment. When you say so, well, you listen to popular music, you need this, when will that happen to you? So naturally, you're thinking, when will it happen to me? When will I get those things? Isn't it so? I mean, most persons your age, they wouldn't come here on a Friday night. You know what they'd be out doing, right? Because they hear, yes, that's where the action is, that's where the pleasure is. Although you look at them, you can see they're suffering so much. Still, because they hear that stuff all the time. So it's really a great thing to start to understand how much of our life is molded by what we hear. That puts some power in your hands. People like to talk about the word empowerment. Well, I don't know exactly what they're talking about when they use that phrase. But actually, if you want to get some power in your life, then if you simply try to get in touch with what your hearing. That's power. And if you want to change your conception of yourself and what you're doing, try changing what you're hearing. That's going to be very difficult. If you go through your life, just try to make a daily study of this. From the time you wake up, the time you go to sleep, make a list of what you're hearing and who you're hearing from. Then you'll find out what you're understanding. Who knows? Maybe if you wake up, first thing that comes on, maybe it's a clock radio. I don't think anybody hears like that. No one wakes up to a clock radio with the news station playing. Anybody? Don't be shy. You do that? Anyway, no. Millions of people in the world do that. And then they even, all right, just like my father. Yes, he wakes up to clock radio, news station, and then he goes in to, goes in the bathroom, brushes his teeth, he's got a radio in there, turns that on, more hearing. Yeah. Then he goes down to the kitchen to get breakfast, there's a radio there, actually there's a television there in the kitchen. You watch the news while you're taking breakfast. Then he jumps in the car to go wherever he's going, and the radio comes on, more hearing. And then meanwhile, there's the, come on in. You have a seat here. You have a seat right there. Well, it's right by the door here. For those who are latecomers. Then, of course, there's the newspaper and magazines. And those of you who are into computers, you know there's the World Wide Web, the Internet, on it goes. So much information people are getting. So if you want to get in control of your life, get in control of what you're hearing. And then you'll start to know what you can understand. How many here have actually thought of that point before? One, two, five. In other words, if we really want to make a radical break away from conditioned thinking, you've got to change what we hear. So the whole Bhagavad Gita is based on changing who you're hearing from. It's not a difficult concept to grasp, but it's very revolutionary in its implications. Just come in and sit down there. Okay, then go for the kitchen. Very revolutionary in its implications. Our whole lost situation is actually a place where we can come in contact with a different kind of sound vibration. Sometimes people come to you and they say, "My house here is so different. Why is that?" Basically because it's the sound vibration is different. You see, when you're always talking about things that subject matters about things that have a beginning and end, your mind gets molded in that. But when you start talking about things that don't have a beginning and end, then your consciousness becomes elevated. If you look in the world around us, you'll notice everything that our naked eye can observe has a beginning and end. Yes? Everything that our naked eye can observe has a beginning and end. Even your dearmost things. Think of anything that's most dear to you in this world, and it'll have a beginning and end. So if you're always hearing talk about things that are beginning and end, you become conditioned that way. And you'll miss out on a whole realm of experience that concerns things that don't have a beginning and end. So Bhagavad Gita is going to teach you that we should be focusing on those things that don't have a beginning and end. That means to enter into the realm of consciousness. How many people have had an education, either in college or university, that taught them all about consciousness? And everybody here has gone to college, and some have gone to university, right? No one has learned anything about consciousness. And it is consciousness that's the difference between a living body and a dead body. Only through consciousness are we aware of anything. Only through consciousness. But we never know what it is. Isn't that amazing? Sure, some of you have wondered about that, right? The very thing that allows you to be aware, we don't know anything about. And we study everything else except that. Why is it that we don't hear much about consciousness? Because you can't observe it with your naked eye. And the so-called advancement of the present civilization is based on that which you can observe with your naked eye. And they've done very well, in one sense, in that way. We have so many technological developments. We won't talk about their hazardous effects on the environment, but just taking them into themselves. They produce a lot of conveniences. So, the present-day human beings have done wonders with what they can see. But it's what they don't see that's causing them a lot of problems. How do you judge environmental damage? How far can you see? How far into the future can you see? So what might produce a convenience now could be jeopardizing your children's lives. How far can you see? Time-wise, how far can you see in terms of what's around you? How deep into the ocean can you see? How far into space can you see? Life is a very tricky business. It involves what you can see and what you can't see. But if you simply build a civilization on what you can see, then it seems quite obvious, oh, we've made so many conveniences. But it's what you don't see that begins to hurt you. And that's what people are finding out now. What we didn't see and what we can see now is causing us problems. You'll never solve all these problems until you get to the root. The root is we don't know what consciousness is. In other words, we don't know what the difference is between a living body and a dead body. Bhagavad Gita is hearing about consciousness. Hearing about consciousness from the Supreme Consciousness. Now, is that really a tough point to swallow, Supreme Consciousness? If we think about it, I have consciousness. So why can't there be a Supreme Consciousness? If we think about it. But they don't teach us in school about our consciousness, and they certainly don't teach you about Supreme Consciousness. Yet, we think we got an education. And then we finish school, we work very hard to please ourselves, and we're never happy, and we wonder why. It's because we don't know anything about consciousness and how to have proper consciousness. Nor do we understand anything about Supreme Consciousness. So these things, these subject matters, are very necessary. Because Bhagavad Gita is spoken by the Supreme Consciousness. That's the difference between Bhagavad Gita and other books. Now you may say, oh, everybody says this. Their book was spoken by the Supreme. Their book was spoken by God. Haven't we had enough of this? Well, you have to see. You have to see what. Otherwise, somebody could be dogmatic by saying, this book is spoken by the Supreme. And somebody could also be dogmatic by saying, no, the book was not spoken by the Supreme. You have to see. You can't take position either way. But these days, you'll find that as soon as you say,
Bhagavad Gita was spoken by the Supreme Consciousness. Most people say, oh, that's really over the top. It's got to be dogma.
Why? Possibly it could be. It could be dogma. It could be somebody just, you know, it could be some religious fanatical statement. But maybe not. In other words, you can't be a fanatic either way. You have to see. Just like if Flo said, this is Alpha, she's my friend. So, oh, I've heard that before. Everybody says that somebody's their friend. It's just a dogmatic statement you're making. You're just making absolute statements. You're setting yourself up on a pedestal on high, saying that Alpha's your friend. Who are we to listen to you? And you would feel a bit insulted. Well, wait a minute. She's my friend. So in other words, for you to say she's your friend, that could be true. But who am I to say no? You could be wrong, or I could be wrong. So if I say no, how dare you say it? How can you say someone's your friend? And if I accuse you of being presumptuous and bold, I'm doing the same thing. We have to see whether she's your friend or not. So how will we tell? Well, we would ask you, well, describe Alpha to us. Let's see if you really know it. And then, of course, we would also ask Alpha, too. So we have to approach Bhagavad Gita with an open mind. And not be so tinged and biased due to imperfect sound vibration we've been hearing. What do you think? It's not unreasonable, is it? Does it sound unreasonable? Yes, sir. Every intelligent man and woman should have a course in Bhagavad Gita. All right. So, we'll turn to chapter 4, text 1. Page 215. Anyone who's too hot, raise your hand. Anyone who's too cool, raise your hand. All those who think it's okay, raise your hand. All right. This is democracy. Page 215. This chapter is called Transcendental Knowledge. Now, when you hear that title, Transcendental Knowledge, what do you think you're about to hear? Our friend, I'm sorry, we didn't get your name. Zeros. Yes, zeros. What? When you hear that chapter title, Transcendental Knowledge, what might you think you're about to hear? Any other, any of our guests here? Let's see who we can ask. Oh, our friend here, what's your name? Catherine, you've been here before? Ah, oh, how nice. When you hear the phrase transcendental knowledge, what is it that you think of? Honest answer? Well, everybody knows there's different types of knowledge. Generally, it comes down to how am I going to eat better, how am I going to sleep more comfortably, how am I going to protect myself from fears, and how to have a better intimate life. Generally, all the things we're studying or hear about come down to those points. But after all is said and done, everybody wants an easier life in terms of physical comforts and lack of physical distress. So, even you're studying some deep subject at the university, your hopes are that somehow or other what you're studying will produce more comforts for yourself. Prestige, bigger salary, some fame, conveniences. There's so many kinds of knowledge, but transcendental knowledge deals with things that don't have a beginning and end. That is the real purpose of having a human body. With the developed consciousness of a human body, you can begin to study transcendental knowledge. But if we go through our whole life without studying, things that don't have a beginning and an end, what a waste. What a waste. It's like this is Joan here. Sometimes we have little play fights because she teaches hairdressing at the Seville School. Yes. So, yeah. One time she gave me a tour of her school. She was very kind. She gave me a tour of the facility. So, of course, I'm always appreciative of her fine character. But at the same time, I always kind of give her a few pokes in the rib, like, what does this really do for people? Sometimes we have kind of a bit of tussles about those things, you know? What does this really do for people, you know? Well, she says, if they can leave, you know, with a nice hairstyle and feeling better about themselves, feeling more positive, then that's something nice. You would agree, yeah? She's smart. She's holding herself. I say, come on, Joan. I mean, really, whether their hair is this way or that way, what's that really got to do with the essential issues of life? After all, it's only going to be a few years before their hair falls out anyway. One of her friends that she brought in here one time, also, what's his name? Also, does he?
Rob,
yes. Where is he? Is he?
I don't know.
Okay. He's also does hair. So he was quite honest. He said, you know, most of the people who come in my shop, my hair, what do you call them? Not shops, but school. Most people who come in, and they, especially older people, they want me to do the impossible. They want me to, you know, give them youth. They come in with this illusion, and I have to fulfill that illusion. So, in one sense, it's nice to have a good hairstyle, but it's going to end. I mean, even if you do up somebody's hair, how long does the style last before they have to come back in? She's being very agreeable, right? I mean, it's not even that you just go to the hairdresser once and it lasts until you die. You have to go in, what is it, once every 2 weeks or something? I don't know. How often? Once a month? Yeah.
Your body breaks down too.
Well, you sound like you're in a bugger. Anyway, come on, say what you usually say. she usually starts to fight with me.
It makes them feel good. You know, they can come in and they may be having problems, but if they get a nice hair spot and they leave with a positive conception of themselves, it's doing good.
Now we ask her. I asked Joan, they leave with a positive conception of themselves. What is the self?
Well, anyway,
the point is they're feeling happier. Joan, even if we allow them to be feeling happier, how long does that happiness last? No, you're really cynical for that. You loved your full-blown optimism. I expected a decent fight from you.
All right.
So that is an example. Hair styling, you know, something everybody understands is temporary. But if we can look at the whole gamut of human activities and see the same thing, that's very good. Apply that to all the activities. Just think of what some of the goals you have. Think of all the goals you have. How are they different from getting a nice hairstyle? Does anybody have any goals that are different from getting a nice hairstyle? Think of what Mike left for example. Well, you're being, you got a room full of honest people here tonight.
But then people tie all those things together and say, you know, when they've got the morbid, they say, I'm living a happy life. You know, like they have the cholesterol and then they have something else. You know, it's good, but...
Well, hopefully when you leave here tonight, you'll understand that when people say, well, anyway, when I look at all the different features and characteristics of my life, I think I'm living a happy life. Hopefully when you leave here tonight, you'll understand that they don't know what is life and what is the I. Just like I would say to Joan. She says, they leave with a positive feeling about themselves. Well, what is the self? They don't know.
Well, what's life?
Right? The transcendental knowledge deals with these things. So I'm trying to, hopefully I'm trying to make what is obvious more obvious. That unless we are concerned with higher things, we're really trapped in deep ignorance. Would anybody object to that? Am I speaking too rigidly? What do you say, Paul? Alpha? Okay. Just wondering what comes next, huh? That's good. Good. You wonder what comes next. What comes next is text number 1 in chapter 4 here. This chapter is called Transcendental Knowledge. We'll just read the Sanskrit. It's very wonderful for the atmosphere, and then we'll explain. Sri Bhagavanuvacha imam vivasvite yogam proktavanam avyayam vivasvamanade praha manarichvakave bravi. Okay, you see this first line in Sanskrit, Sri Bhagavanuvacha. Very important. It describes the qualifications of who's speaking. Now, you see, if you've got discrimination, you always try to understand the qualification of who's talking to. Just like if Graham here began to explain to me why Alpha is Flo's friend, I don't think I'd listen. Why is that? Right. So in other words, before I would take you seriously, that you could tell me about the relationship between Alpha and Flo, I'd have to really understand your qualifications and knowing both of them. Otherwise, I wouldn't listen. Before we listen to anybody, we should understand what are the qualifications. So this term, Bhagavan, that is Krishna's qualification. When you hear the word Krishna, I don't know what you think of. What do you think of? Yeah. Like what? Okay, let's see. A new person. What's your name again? Sorry. Christy, when you hear the word Krishna, what do you think? Honest answers. But you've heard the word before, right? And what came into your mind? Hmm. this Sanskrit word Bhagavan, it helps you to understand Krishna's qualification. Bhaga means opulences. Van means one who possesses. Well, what's the big deal about that? People have different opulences. They have different nice things about their life. But no, this word Bhagavan, this nomenclature, this terminology, refers to quite extraordinary things. The Vedic literature has analyzed that there are six main opulences. They are wealth, strength, renunciation, that's hard to understand as an opulence, beauty, knowledge, and fame. If you analyze what is attractive in people's lives, you'll find it's one of those six things. Wealth, strength, knowledge, beauty, fame. I missed one. Renunciation. That's a tough one to understand these days, how it's an opulence. You think you know somebody who's strong? Anyone? You think you know somebody who's very strong? Who? Oh, you saw the movie on TV, huh?
Yeah.
Half man, half God, right? Why was he half man, half God? Oh, I see. Anybody else watch Hercules on Channel 3? Only Club? So, all I know is the big signs around the city. Half man, half God, Hercules. And on some of the signs, they had a young girl in the background. Some of them they didn't. What happened to Hercules at the end? What happened to him at the end?
I don't know. I know that Hercules is a strong man.
In any case, real strength means you can conquer the laws of nature. You're not controlled by the laws of nature. Did you ever think of that as a definition of strong? If you're under control of the laws of nature, you're not really strong. Yes, that means weak. No, very simple. If you're really strong, then you're stronger than the laws of nature. Right. Very good, Joan. Therefore, Krishna has the title Bhagavan because he has unlimited strength. In all the six things, Krishna is unlimitedly deep. Unlimited wealth, strength, knowledge, beauty, fame, renunciation. You've seen these things present in small degrees in everybody, but you've never seen infinite capacity. That is the nature of the speaker of Bhagavad Gita. That's a very bold statement, isn't it? That Krishna possesses infinite opulences, infinite intelligence, infinite beauty. No question of the Supreme Consciousness being an old man or some vague force. Not at all. When you open Bhagavad Gita, you're about to hear from the source, the original source of unlimited opulences. Is that a bit too much for us? Does your mind kind of say, sounds like Hercules or mythology? It's amazing. We may think that that kind of thing is mythology, but when it comes to our own little tiny lives with our own little tiny opulences, we take it all so seriously. Just like the people who come to Joan's school, hairdressing school. They're just trying to get a little bit of beauty. And they're so happy if you can move their hair this way and that way and create a little bit of temporary beauty before the wind blows. But if we say that Krishna is the source of infinite beauty,
oh, no, that's mythology.
But if we say go to the hairdressing, civil hairdressing school and get your hair done,
oh,
very serious. How much will it cost? Who should I, which hairdresser should I get? It's a very serious business. Why are we so biased against hearing about the unlimited source of all opulences?
Why you make him out fighting a system man? Why you make him out fighting a system
man? So
way up.
I never said way up.
So did you see that? I mean, You're sort of separating so much.
No, oh, I said that Krishna is the source of unlimited opulence.
Yeah.
So I said at this point. Right? Isn't that all I said at this point?
No. Maybe it's not much different to us. But maybe
maybe.
Well, that's
a good point. What is the difference between Krishna and us? Are there some things we have in common? Good point.
Are we going all that proportion of it? Are we blowing all that proportion
of it? Blowing what out of proportion?
No.
Bhagavad Gita has its unique contribution because it's coming from the infinite. And I guess the infinite is way out of proportion as we conceive of it. When you say something's out of proportion, it's just in reference to whose measurement. Exactly. Just like the story about the frog in the well. It's a story that's popular amongst ourselves, the regulars here. There was a frog who inhabited a well, and another frog came along and told him, "You think your well is very big, but have you heard about the Atlantic Ocean?" And the frog who lived in the well said, "I think you're a bit over the top. I think you're blowing things up a bit. I don't think there can be any ocean as big as what you've described." And the other frog, who traveled a bit and heard, said, "No, there's an Atlantic Ocean. It's so big you can't get to the end. You'll never be able to swim to the end of the Atlantic Ocean." And the frog in the well said, "I can't believe it. I've been in my well all my life, and I know how water is. I know how bodies of water, how they act, how big they are." So then the skeptical frog said, I know. He puffed up his belly a bit. "Is Atlantic Ocean this bigger than my belly?" And the traveling frog said, "No, it's much bigger." Puffed it out some more. "Is it this bigger?" "No, it's much bigger." "Oh, I can't believe that anything is bigger than three times how I can swell up my belly." The other frog said, "No, it's much bigger." And the frog kept puffing out his belly until finally what happened? It conversed. So we're a bit like that. How big is Krishna? Is he this big? Is he that big? Oh, this is sounding a bit over the top. It's sounding a bit exaggeration. That big? No, I can't believe anything is that big. But in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, he has no beginning, no end. And that supreme absolute truth that has no beginning and no end can speak. Here we are, little tiny things, and we can talk and make some attempt at giving knowledge. Why do we deny that the Supreme Consciousness? Why do we say the Supreme Consciousness can't speak? Why are we so dogmatic? So presumptuous. We're talking all the time about so many silly things. But when it comes to hearing from the Supreme Consciousness, oh, that can't be. We're using words all the time. And things are happening because of our words. You know that common expression, loose lips sink ships? You don't have that one in this country. Well, you know, a loose tongue. There must be some local statement about what a loose tongue can do. You probably heard that, Chloe. Somebody gossips what damage they cause. Something like that. So in any case, our words have some effect. And we're just tiny little things. Try to understand. You actually can't calculate the effect of the words coming from the supreme intelligence. Now see, what you didn't hear when you first came was that we were talking about consciousness and supreme consciousness. So you've actually pushed things into a right situation. What is the difference between individual consciousness and supreme consciousness? That is explained in Bhagavad Gita. We are all conscious, but we are only conscious of our limited existence, to some extent. We can understand, we're consciously aware of our hunger and our thirst, but we're not aware of what it's like. In somebody else's mind, they haven't been there. We can conceive what it's like, but we actually have to interact with the spirit. So we only know what goes on in our body. We're conscious only, we know what goes on in our body. But the supreme consciousness knows what goes on in all the bodies. So here's the reality. The individual soul is conscious. The pure living entity, pure spirit soul, takes birth in the material realm of temporary matter is because of envy of the supreme consciousness. And we can feel that in us.
Supreme opposite one.
But then we'd love to hear about some tiny creature with a little bit of opulence. Right? I don't know anything about God, so I don't know anything about his will. So anyway, we may find out about that in the course of... No. Maybe not. You'll hear about that also. All these points you're raising are covered in Bhagavad Gita. We just have to kind of hear. Let the sound vibration go into the ear and let's explore it, and then we can kind of react this way or that way. You know what I mean? Just kind of let things develop. Just let it hang in the air for a while. And then at the end, we can, well, know about this Christian. Maybe, maybe not. But let's just let it develop for a while, you know what I mean? So, Bhagavan means the source of infinite opulences. And certainly speaking is ordinary. You can speak, why can't the Supreme Consciousness speak? But Krishna speaking, that is something special. Although the speaking ability is shared by you and Krishna, Krishna speaking is of a different nature, because if Krishna is the source of everything, that means he knows everything. Because all of the energies are coming from Krishna. Now you know about the you know about some of the energies coming from you. I can only think of one example. Please don't mind it. I gotta think of a better one. Have you ever been to India? In India, hepatitis is quite common. Everybody knows what hepatitis is. It's a liver disease. They're different strains. Some are contagious, some aren't. So, the way you tell if you have hepatitis for sure is when your stool turns white. After a while, if you have hepatitis, your eyes will become yellow. But that's basically by the time that happens, the disease has been well progressed. But in the beginning, you can know for sure when your stool turns white. So that stool is your energy. And if you go to India, you watch. You look because make sure you don't have anything. So you're looking at your energy. There's so many emanations that we have that we look at and analyze. We recognize this is my energy. Well, Krishna is the source of all the energy. That claim is made in Bhagavad Gita. Sounds very presumptuous, but we have to see if Krishna can back up his claim in Bhagavad Gita.
Can you see him in the right light?
We'll get to all your points. Just be patient. Proportion, Krishna's infinite. No question of proportion as we can conceive of. Let's just listen. Let's just listen. Be patient. Be patient now.
You can't see things as they should be.
Just be patient. Just listen. And we'll talk more about that here. Just listen very patiently. Be peaceful.
Because we don't understand, so we keep on wondering about
it. Okay, but just wait, just listen.
If we see things in the right light, then it doesn't mean anything. It's not
a speech. So, we'll read the translation. Who can read? We have a good voice. Janine, you have a... Jillian or Janine?
Janelle.
Janelle.
Sorry.
Can you read the translation, please?
Personally, I instructed
the Sankara
King of Science
and Yoga
to
the Sankara. Nivashwan.
Nivashwan, and
Nivashwan
instructed it to
Mother,
the father of mankind. And then
it instructed it to Shvaku. Now we're getting to point one, the cosmological history of the Yuna. We have the Supreme, Infinite, Ultimate One saying, I taught this imperishable science of yoga to the chief person on the sun planet. Now this is getting pretty far out, isn't it? First we are hearing about the Supreme Infinite Optimism. Now we're hearing about the chief executive head of the sun. These are all things that are beyond our vision. But just because it's beyond our vision, does it mean it doesn't exist? How many of you have been to the Arctic Circle? Nobody. But you all accept that it exists? How? Christine, how do you accept that the Arctic Circle exists? Right! Yes. With a simple, clear-cut attitude like that, you can understand heaps. Apply that same attitude of pristine simplicity to hearing Bhagavad Gita. It's not very complicated at all. Complicated for the complicated, simple for the those who have pristine clarity. So, we want to learn, we hear about it. Now suppose I say, I don't believe that there's the Arctic Circle. What can you say? What would you say, Christine, if I said, I don't believe that there's the Arctic Circle? Why? Why?
Yeah,
just because I heard about it doesn't mean I believe it.
What if you explain it?
But everybody here already said they haven't been there. Have you seen it? How have you seen it? I've seen it. It's gotta be true. No doubt about it.
Good one, Flo.
You've seen it on TV, it's got to be real, right? That's the test.
The cameras don't lie.
Cameras don't lie. Now, if I was going to harass you and say, I don't believe the Arctic Circle exists, ultimately, after getting exasperated, you'd tell me, just go there, find out for yourself. So in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is not being dogmatic. He presents the process by which you can verify what he's saying. So what do you want from Krishna? If you're interested in all these things, Krishna gives you the process how to verify it. The problem with modern society today is they're not interested in these things. If we had a meeting tonight, an advertiser, all those who want to learn how to make $1 million in 1 week, please come. We need a stadium to build these things. All those who want to hear exotic secrets from Tibet about how to improve their intimate life. Oh, everybody would come. But if we say, all those who want to understand how to escape this world of birth and death and the clutches of temporary time and space.
Who cares? This is a problem with modern society.
They don't know what to do with their intelligence. If we put up a sign saying, we have Joan here on Friday nights. Anyone who comes here can get free hairstyling.
Oh, we have hundreds of people lined up.
If we say, we have Bhagavad Gita here, come and understand transcendental knowledge. And then we get the fortunate 20 or so we have here. That shows you about the state of society, the condition of society today.
Okay, well,
so, the chief of the sun. How can anybody live on the sun? Come on. Did somebody want to say that? Didn't anybody want to say that?
How can somebody live on the sun?
You wanted to say that, Graham, right?
Good
enough. He said it before in the back. That's what we need. A living specimen here. I said it before in the past. How do we know no one lives on the sun? It's too hot, right? But you're thinking that if they have bodies like us, then they can't live there. But the Vedic literature, of which Bhagavad Gita is the essence, they reveal that there's life everywhere. And that according to the different atmospheres in the universe, the living entities have different kinds of bodies. On some planets, the predominant atmosphere is water. On others, it's fire. On others, it's earth. And so the living entities there have bodies accordingly. So, on the sun globe, the living entities have bodies made of fire. They don't have any problem.
And they say, oh, that sounds too fantastic.
But even on this planet, there are creatures that have bodies that allow them to live in water. You can't do it. You can't live in water. But the fish can. But you put the fish on dry land and they die. Put you in the water and you die. So the whole universe is like that. There are creatures adapted to particular living environments. Don't think because you can't live there, no one can. That's as stupid a thing, because you can't live underwater, no one can. So in Bhagavad Gita, you get that kind of information. What goes on other planets? The type of life forms there. Fascinating. Just like you have a Prime Minister of New Zealand. Folger, is that his name? Yeah.
Folger.
So, everywhere you'll find some chief living entity. And the sun globe also has its chief.
So Krishna's saying here, I spoke the imperishable science of yoga to the chief living entity who lives in the fire on the sun. Yeah. What are you going to do about it? It really challenges our conceptions. This is the cosmological history of Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita gives you information in a nutshell about the whole universe. Okay. And then we read that the sun god, in response, instructed to Manu, the father of mankind. And Manu, in turn, instructed to Ishvaku. These are very great personalities, far beyond the capacity or capability of anybody existing today. And Krishna is tracing out how the knowledge of Bhagavad Gita came down. Books are a recent invention. The Vedic literature has described that previously people's memory was so sharp that just by hearing they could understand. We need books because memory has decreased. In other civilizations, people can hear and memorize accurately, but that's a lost art today.
So we need books.
Let me find for a question. Let us read the first part of the purport. Amen. You can read the first paragraph.
Herein we find the history of the Bhagavad Gita, traced from a remote time when it was delivered to the world order of all planets, beginning from the sun planet. The kings of all planets are especially meant for the protection of the inhabitants, and therefore the royal order should understand the science of Bhagavad Gita in order to be able to rule citizens and protect them from material bondage to lust. Human life is meant for cultivation of spiritual knowledge, an eternal relationship with the supreme personality of Godhead, and the executive heads of all the states and all planets are obliged to impart this lesson to citizens by education, culture, and devotion. In other words, the executive heads of all states are intended to spread the science of Krishna consciousness, so that the people may take advantage of this great science and pursue a successful path, utilizing the opportunity of this living life.
That was quite a paragraph, wasn't it? Yes. The history of Bhagavad Gita has been traced from the time when it was delivered to the royal order on all planets. In a nutshell, you're finding out that government has a purpose, and it's more than simply making sure there's a good economy. The government is supposed to deliver transcendental knowledge to the people, because that's the purpose of human life. Therefore, it's natural, when you understand that point, it's natural that Krishna will speak Bhagavad Gita to the chiefs of the planets, because they're the ones who are supposed to make sure that the human civilization or the sun planet civilization is going on according to the proper way of spiritual development. So Krishna, the Supreme Consciousness, knows where to teach Bhagavad Gita. Teach it to the heads of the planets and let them pass it down. Because the purpose of life in this universe is to become spiritually enlightened. So Krishna, the Supreme Source, starts that enlightenment process off. Who better can give knowledge of Krishna than Krishna? Just like if we want to understand Joan, you ask Joan, who's a better authority? Just like I expected to hear from her. Her usual comments about how hairstyling makes people feel good, and she just said the opposite. And everybody listened to her, not me, because if Joan's here, she knows what she means. Right? I tried to paint a picture of her, and she just said the opposite. And obviously you believe her about what she thinks. So if you want to understand the Supreme Consciousness, you hear from the Supreme Consciousness. And in Bhagavad Gita, we have that opportunity. We'll go to the next text. Text number two. Evam parampara praptam imam raja seyo vidu sakalinaha mahata yoga nasta parantapa. We'll read the translation.
Well, very sorry to push the channel. I'm going to push the channel.
enemies appears to be lost. So Krishna is saying that this knowledge of Bhagavad Gita is passed down through a line, authorized line of persons. But sometimes there's a miscommunication. Now how does that happen? It's not that during the time Krishna spoke Bhagavad Gita, which was approximately 5,000 years ago, there was any shortage of scholars. No. What makes the message of Bhagavad Gita appear to be lost is when there is distortion and speculation and interpretation. Just like you go to a bookstore today, you'll find so many versions of Bhagavad Gita in English. How many will you find that present Krishna's words and Krishna's meaning as it is? So when there's so much interpretation by so-called scholars, then the meaning of Bhagavad Gita appears to be lost. And whenever that happens to a great degree, Krishna himself does something about it. Just like if people start talking about Joan, we don't know her, and they start making up all these interpretations and speculations about her. After a while, she's going to get a bit angry and say, look, I'm going to tell you how I am. I'm tired of all these rumors and gossip. I think this, I think like that. No matter what Devanrita Swami said, I'm not a fanatic about hairstyling. Everybody will listen to her. Oh, Joan is speaking. She knows herself. So Krishna does the same thing. Enough of all these crazy versions of Bhagavad Gita that try to push me out of Bhagavad Gita. I will reestablish the original meaning, loud and clear. And Krishna is doing that on a battlefield. That's what's going on in the cover. In between two opposing armies, in this most dramatic moment, Krishna is reestablishing the meaning of Bhagavad Gita. Which is especially meant to guide human society, not to be an escapist religious literature. That's why Krishna is speaking on the Bhagavad Gita. There's nothing escapist about Bhagavad Gita. It's spoken in the most active place you can imagine. That's another point anyway. Who's escaping? Who's escaping reality? Even if you say that someone who is practicing spiritual life seriously is trying to escape, even if you want to look at it from that point of view, what is so wonderful about the way the world is now that someone shouldn't escape? It's like if you're in a burning house and then you run out and they say, oh, you escaped! You're escaping! You say, hey, get off my case, the house is on fire. No, you're an escapist, you're escaping! People don't like that. We have to understand what is reality and what is illusion. And then we can understand who is escaping and whether you should escape or not. People act like this world is in such wonderful shape that how can you dare leave it? But when you read Bhagavad Gita, you find out how life should be lived. And then you don't settle for the trash anymore. So maybe that's enough for this week. Number one, the cosmological history of the Gita. It takes into account all planets and their differing conditions, the different types of bodies on each planet. And Krishna picks out the chiefs of the planets, and he speaks Bhagavad Gita to them, and they pass it down to the people. And whenever the meaning gets lost, Krishna himself comes and makes it clear. All right. Any questions from those who probably may not have said anything tonight?
Hi, Christine.
What do you think, Christine? Some possibilities? Still water runs deep. Anyone else? Well, you know I was going to pick on you.
No, that's only for me.
Alpha, you'll be what Flo does. Right, your friend. Janine. Oh, she's in your group too.
Yes.
Oh, you've got great friends.
Everyone's like
Greenwald. Okay, Greenwald. Janine, Janine? Janelle, I'll get it one day. You see, you may notice every time you have these Friday night heater discussions, we can go on and on like this. It's really enthralling. You even forget about your you forget about your temporary bodies. You forget about your anxieties before you came here. That's the power of transcendental subject matter. That's the power of hearing about Krishna. Talks about Krishna are not different from Krishna's presence. That's why the atmosphere here changes whenever we talk about Krishna. Yes. Yes. Krishna comes and does that directly, or he empowers other beings to do that. Yes. Our Swami Prabhupada. Yes, reclarified Bhagavad Gita. That's why it's called Bhagavad Gita as it is. You may say, well, everybody says that their version is the version. You can read for yourself and see. Krishna's words come out so clearly. The purports are not interpretations, they are just broadcasting what the text said. I'm not finished. You have to be patient. You have to be patient here. I'm answering Paul's question. It's a very good question. Because as I was saying, there's so many scholarly misinterpretations of Bhagavad Gita. And people get no benefit when there's that misinterpretation. You see, if you're going to take Bhagavad Gita as it is, you can't brush away the fact that Krishna is the Supreme Consciousness. Otherwise, the whole thing loses value. The whole thing loses its point. The point of Bhagavad Gita is to teach the imperishable science of yoga. Yoga means to link. It doesn't mean simply physical exercises. No, yoga means to link the individual soul with the Supreme Soul. So, when you read Bhagavad Gita, that link should be reestablished between the individual consciousness and the Supreme Consciousness. So I think that's enough for now. You can talk more at the table, okay? I don't know so many Babas in India, I don't know them all, but we're talking of Bhagavad Gita. Well, thank you all for coming, and hopefully some of you will give Bhagavad Gita a wondrous reading and